Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, business, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So, stay tuned for tonight's special report on reality behind the news right after this. Hey, let me ask you this. What do you think's wrong with the Ten Commandments? Because it's pretty obvious that something is wrong with the Ten Commandments because they've been banned from our public schools, from our public institutions, and from our national consciousness. Now, instead of these ten simple, time-tested laws, we see the ten planks to the Communist Manifesto. And they're teaching these ten planks to the Communist Manifesto in our public schools and our public institutions. And we've been taught to make them a part of our national psyche. You know, this is a pretty radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years, don't you think? Are you aware, for instance, that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but she can have an abortion arranged through that same public school without even your knowledge, much less your consent? That's why I contend that the solution to this kind of moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. You know, our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments. They even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's still at least one school left in America that's teaching this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties and the benefits for their observance. Now, you know, every law has a penalty, and you don't have to know what the penalty to the law is in order to suffer from its effects. So whether we call this the Mosaic Law, or the Law of God, or the Common Law, or Natural Law, or Karma, or something else, it's automatic, and it works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happen to be the natural penalties for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Doesn't cost anything. And it's educational, it's informative, and it's entertaining. You can call right now and order one. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. And click on to the archives page, and you can download that free General Law CD package right there. Again, georgegordon.org, and then go to the archives page or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're looking at reality behind the news, and so in this last program in the series, I picked up the International Forecaster. You can get a copy from. This is the December 11th issue that I'm citing from here, December 11th, 2010. And it's the internationalforecaster.com. And if you want to write that down, you write, see if I got it here. Yeah, here it is, HTTP. And it says theinternationalforecaster.com. And it's all one word, theinternationalforecaster.com. And the guy that writes this, his name is Bob Chapman, an old man like I am. And he's out here spreading the word and stirring up a lot of hate and discontent in the process. First article I want to cover here, page 18. Representative Cohen moves to block free speech. Free speech. My God, we'd think the First Amendment protects our right to free speech and that all of our senators and representatives would be championing the idea of free speech. But there's quite a little story here. It has to do with these FEMA camps here in the United States. You might have heard a little about that. Concentration camps here in the United States. The first time I heard this was from my son Ted back about 1985 or 86, somewhere along in there. And he was stationed up in Anchorage, Alaska. And we were talking on the telephone and he said, Dad, I don't know what's going on up here. But I'm out here working on a project. We are building a great big compound with barracks in it. And it's not for the Army. It's not for us soldiers. And I said, well, Ted, that's a concentration camp that you're building. I'd heard about this, and I was reporting on it, and I said, that's a concentration camp. And he said, Dad, what makes you say that? And I said, because the fence that you have, the fence that you're building around it, the barbed wire is aimed in, not out. See, if you were building a compound to protect the people inside, you would aim the barbed wire out to keep people from the outside from getting in. I said, the barbed wire is facing in, isn't it? And he said, well, yeah, it is. Okay, well, that's for keeping people inside from getting out. That's a concentration camp. Over the years, I've heard reports about these FEMA camps, and here's a new report, only this one has been broadcast over national TV. So more and more people are finding out about it. I just thought I'd throw it out there if you hadn't heard about it, or if you had, here's an update to it. This is contact Debbie Morgan, media at campfema.com. I remember this report's coming out in the International Forecaster, dated Saturday, December 11th, 2010. So if you want a copy of it, send your request to theinternationalforecaster.com. Tell them you want the December 11th, 2010 edition. That's the Saturday, December 11th edition on page 18. News of FEMA camps proves too much for prime time as True TV has been coerced to pull the police state episode of Conspiracy Theory with Jesse Ventura. They had to take it off the air. Well, that's censorship, and that's detrimental to free speech. The episode, which featured Alex Jones, Catherine Blesch, John Bush, and Camp FEMA director William Lewis, talked about many things. But the one fact that seems to have caused the biggest trouble for Ventura and True TV is the FEMA camps. Troubled by the blatant omission of the episode in reruns, Camp FEMA producer Gary Franchi said they have only fanned the flames and brought greater attention to the issue. It's an admission to the truth about FEMA camps in America. Jones, on his radio program InfoWars, said that he was at liberty to speak about part of the cover-up. He said, Tennessee Representative Steve Cohen sent letters to Time Warner. He sent letters to Subdivision True TV and even managed to get the ADL involved behind the scenes. Toward the end of the program in question, Jesse Ventura speaks to Cohen about the legislation, H.R. 645, the National Emergency Centers Establishment Act. Cohen seemed not to recognize the bill until Ventura presented him with a copy of it on camera. In response to Ventura and the police state episode, Cohen took a Southern Poverty Law Center type stance in his scathing op-ed for Roll Call on December the 7th, 2010, in which he said, quote, when the media purposely distort the facts to create confusion and mislead people, they must be held accountable, Franchi stated. The censorship of True TV almost mirrors the attack levied against our film camp FEMA, American Lockdown, by the Southern Poverty Law Center after its broadcast on PBS. Well, Cohen wrote that the legislation that he co-sponsored with my colleagues, H.R. 645, which has never even passed out of a subcommittee, would be used to establish emergency operations centers to share information and provide assistance in case of emergencies and natural disasters. Well, that part is true. But what Cohen conveniently forgets to mention is that this sort of thing has happened before in the United States, and it wasn't as innocent as he claims. I'll point out here, boys and girls, that during World War II, we had concentration camps here in the United States in which we locked up American citizens. Well, of course, they were a bunch of Japs, and we were at war with Japan, but I want to point out that they were all United States citizens. Now, maybe we needed to lock up these Japanese Americans during World War II. And maybe, just maybe, we need to lock up all Muslim U.S. citizens in a future war with the Muslim world. Or, gee, maybe we need to lock up all of you Korean citizens in FEMA camps when we go to war against North Korea. I don't know. Maybe it's a good policy. But I just wanted to point out that there are concentration camps, new ones, new ones. You know, we tore down all those World War II concentration camps. We got new ones all over America. One of them up in Anchorage, Alaska. Been there at least since 1985 or 6 when my boy Ted reported that to me. Boys and girls, is there some other things that maybe we ought to know about that we haven't heard over the news? Now, Lewis and Franchi remind viewers in their documentary, it's called Camp FEMA, that American citizens have already been the victims of internet and internment, as more than two-thirds of those interred during World War II in the United States were, in fact, American citizens. Internment camp survivor Sam Ozaki gives a chilling account of what happened while in these facilities. When Franklin D. Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, we were all rounded up like cattle and placed into America's concentration camps. Ozaki reminds viewers they called them assembly centers. A newscaster at the time stated that these assembly centers were bounded by a wire fence and guarded by military police. Ozaki remembers that at least 10 persons shot and killed by American guards for getting too close to the fences surrounding the encampment. Okay, so at least 10 persons in these camps were shot and killed during World War II. So that tells you that they were pretty serious about keeping those people locked up in there. Ventura, along with Jones and Lewis and Franchi, simply want to know if these are for emergencies and natural disasters like Hurricane Katrina. And if so, why would there be barbed wire facing toward the facility keeping people in? And why are these facilities being built on military bases? Now, since the release of Camp FEMA, American lockdown, and the enemy of the state, Camp FEMA Part 2 and the one airing of the Ventura True TV Police State episode, Lewis and Franchi have received emails telling of peculiar behavior in several areas of the country, most notably in Charlotte, North Carolina. So you people living in Charlotte, North Carolina, pay attention here, where there are several guard towers going up all over the city, but especially near vacant warehouses. Some were even going up near football stadiums. He even noticed towers going up in Virginia as well. Now, one person speaks of FEMA building on every exposed area at a school in his area, in Kansas. Another writes that a major facility to be shared by the Armed Forces, National Guard, and emergency housing for FEMA is being built near a major artery in Wichita, Kansas. You people in Wichita, keep your eyes and ears open. They got one there. Now, Cohen and the government are bent on covering up any of this information and then demonizing anyone that speaks out and reports about it. Lewis and Franchi have already been targeted by the Southern Poverty Law Center, and CNN in what can only be described as damage control. Lewis states, the harder they try to cover this up, the more apparent it becomes. FEMA camps are a reality in the United States of America, and Representative Cohen's actions prove, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that it's true. Now, if you'd like more information on these two FEMA documentary films and to view the trailers, please visit http://campfema.com. The second one is Police State, Jesse Ventura's FEMA camp episode pulled by Congressman Cohen and the ADL. Go to http://www.federaljack.com. Cohen, we must hold the media accountable. http://www.rollcall.com. Lawmaker, Jesse Ventura's show on U.S. concentration camps outrageous. http://www.scriptsnews.com. CNN, an SPLC attempt to demonize blackball patriots. http://www.takebackwashington.com. All right, and if you want a copy of the article, you can get one from the International Forecaster, Saturday, December the 11th, 2010. By sending your request to theinternationalforecaster.com, theinternationalforecaster.com. Well, let me circle that one off. That was a pretty good story. These are articles and pieces of information and news that you probably haven't heard, and that's because it's censored here in the United States, censored by our news media. On page 5, there's a story about Minnesota's Attorney General sued Discover yesterday, accusing one of the nation's biggest credit card companies of billing tens of thousands of the state's customers for account protection programs that they didn't want. That's called fraud. If I did something like that, they would prosecute me and put me in jail. If you did that, you would be prosecuted and put in jail. If Bank of America, Discover, or J.P. Morgan does it, it may not even be reported, but nobody goes to jail, and if they pay a fine, that's the end of it. So if they steal $1 billion from people out in the marketplace, then when the government finds out about it, they will fine them $100 million. And you've seen these stories. Bank of America fined $100 million for stealing $2 billion. Well, excuse me, boys and girls, but don't you think that when somebody steals $2 billion or something on that order, that they ought to forfeit those ill-gotten gains as well as pay the fine? Okay, but banks never do that. Banks get to keep all of the ill-gotten gains, and then they pay a pittance, and nobody is prosecuted, and they don't go to jail. Here's an example of it. The lawsuit alleges that Discover Bank, DFS Services, and parent company Discover Financial Services broke state consumer fraud and deceptive trade practices laws. Attorney General Lori Swanson sued on behalf of the Minnesota public, but said the billing practices are probably widespread in other states, and she's seeking refunds from Minnesota customers and civil penalties. Swanson said Discover telemarketers talked fast, skipped over words, and rushed customers through a script to sign them up for the programs, including payment protection, identity theft protection, and credit monitoring. All right, now that's the story on the Discover card. Now there's a second story here on the International Forecaster that deals with Bank of America. Here's the second one. Bank of America Corporation agreement to pay $137 million in restitution for taking part in a nationwide bid rigging conspiracy for municipal investment contracts may soon be followed by more settlements to repay the scheme's victims, the Justice Department's Antitrust Division head said. All right, here's the story. Stay tuned to this channel. I think you'll see a lot more activity in the coming weeks and months. Christine Varney, the antitrust chief, told reporters yesterday that we're committed to getting restitution, full restitution, to all of the municipalities that were victims of this scheme. Bank of America, which has assisted the government probe of the $2.8 trillion municipal bond market since at least 2007 in return for leniency, has provided documents, emails, and recordings of phone calls, according to court records, of civil suits. In September, Douglas Lee Campbell, former employee of the bank's Municipal Derivatives Group, pleaded guilty to taking part in a conspiracy to pay state and local governments below market rates on investments purchased with bond proceeds. Bank of America's settlement is likely the tip of the iceberg, Andrew Gavel, a law professor at the Howard University in Washington, D.C., said in an email. He said other conspirators may pay much higher penalties. The government has identified more than a dozen firms, including J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, UBS AG, and Societe Generale as unindicted co-conspirators in a criminal case brought by the Justice Department against a Los Angeles investment broker. Now listen, these are big banks. These are the world's biggest banking institutions, and they're involved in defrauding municipal entities, corporations, you know, like Los Angeles and New York and so on, out of, what was the number up here? It was in the trillions, $2.8 trillion municipal bond market, going back as far as 2007. You know, trillion here and a trillion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money, you know. And I just wanted to point out that these big institutions stealing, you know, from the public. What do you think? We had a woman here the other day, and she was, you know, some little town of Nixa, I think it was, Nixa, Missouri. And she was an accountant or something in there, and she stole $27,000. From, you know, she embezzled the money out of the little, and she paid her bills with it, and she circulated the money in the local community. She just got sentenced to 5 years in the state pen for $27,000. These bastards steal $2.8 trillion, and there isn't a one of them going to spend a minute in jail. Now wake up here, let's smell some coffee, huh? And that goes on day in and day out. Hell, they even report that kind of activity in the mainstream press. But I just thought I'd point that out. There's a couple of cases. Bank of America and Discover Card. Blatant criminals. Blatant theft and criminal activity. Right in your face. And then your government's involved in the cover-up because you remember reading about all of these this TARP payments that went to these big banks like Chase Manhattan. And then when a couple of representatives like Ron Paul, you know, had the temerity to say, hey, we'd like to see your records and where you spent it, they held it up, and they still are holding it up. And they call it top secret. See, they've hidden it under the guise of national security. And then when WikiLeaks comes up and exposes this kind of chicanery, then our government comes to us and says, you know, we need to shut this man up. You know, he's involving national security. Yeah, WikiLeaks, the national security, they're uncovering the lying hypocrites and the frauds and the criminals in government and big business that are raping, robbing, and pillaging all of us. All right, so there's that story. That's number page 5 and 6 over there. Those are pretty good stories. Let's go over here to page 9 and 10. See what we got over here. There's Bank of America on page 6. Here's page 8. Ah, here we go. U.S. home values are poised to drop by more than $1.7 trillion this year. I think I'll underline $1.7 trillion. That's $1,700 billion. Hey, that's a chunk of change. I did a program here not too long ago. If you were to put $1 trillion into $100 bills and then stack it up on pallets 3 feet high and put 26 of those pallets into a semi truck. You know those big trucks with those boxes, you know, driving up down the road, you know? Okay. Write this down. This'll boggle your husband's mind tonight over dinner. That would take 384 semi trucks, those big 18-wheel trucks. 384 trucks. And each one of those trucks would be carrying 26 pallets. That's how much fits into one of those trucks. A pallet's 3.5 by 4 feet. 3.5 by 4 feet, 3 feet high, and the truck would be overloaded. It would have over 40,000 pounds in it. 384 of those truckloads to haul $1 trillion, and we're talking about $1.7 trillion this year. That's how much money all of us homeowners are going to lose this year in the value of our homes. So says Zillow Incorporated, a closely held provider of home price data. This year's estimated decline, more than $1.05 trillion drop in 2009, brings the loss since the June 2006 home price peak to $9 trillion, the Seattle-based company said today in a statement. $9 trillion. Boys and girls, we lost $9 trillion worth of our value. That's 9 times 384 trucks so far since 2006. Now, with foreclosures near an all-time high in late 2010, the high rates of negative equity persisting, it does not appear that the first part of 2011 will bring us much relief. Stan Humphries, Zillow's chief economist, said in the statement, government incentives can only temporarily hold back the tide. Housing demand has slumped since the start of the year as the government tax credit expired and unemployment hovers near 10%. Sales of existing homes in October fell to an annual pace of 4.43 million compared with 5.98 million a year earlier, and an annual average of 5.81 million over the past decade. The National Association of Realtors said November 23rd, the median price was $170,500. That's down from $172,000 a year earlier. If you go back 3 years, it was over $200,000. More than $1 trillion of this year's decline in home values occurred in the second half, Zillow said. Federal tax credits of as much as $8,000 for qualified first-time home buyers and $6,500 for repeat buyers required a sales contract by April 30th of 2010. Only 31 metropolitan areas, or fewer than one-fourth of the 129 tracked by Zillow, had gains in home values this year. They included Boston, San Diego. But Zillow's report is similar to other forecasts for prolonged weakness in the U.S. housing market. U.S. home prices will decline as much as 11% by 2012 as weak demand and rising inventory extend the housing slump, Morgan Stanley said in a report yesterday. Prices will be as much as 36% below their 2006 peak before finding a bottom. Morgan Stanley analysts, led by Oliver Chang, wrote, sales will stay depressed through next year amid tightened lending standards, they said. As many as 8 million homes are in default or foreclosure and may be offered for sale, known as shadow inventory, according to Morgan Stanley. The looming supply will combine with tight credit and questions about housing finance regulation to reduce prices 6 to 11% from current levels, the analyst said. Okay, now let's take a few of these numbers and run them by you. We're expecting 6 to 11% fewer home sales. There's 8 million homes out there that aren't being offered for sale. We're selling houses at the rate of 4 million a year. The normal rate is about 6 million, just a little less than 6. So they're down 2 million a year, home sales. There's about 8 million houses that would be about a 2-year supply that aren't even on the market. They're holding them off the market because if they put those on the market, it would depress it even further and faster. Isn't that special? Now, prices are down 36% so far. Prices will be as much as 36% below their 2006 peak before finding a bottom. I can remember here 2 or 3 years ago, this same author, this is the international forecaster, Bob Chapman, said you could expect house prices to drop 40 to 50%. That was 2 or 3 years ago. And sure enough, it's happened. That's where we're at. Well, we're not at 40%. We're 4 percentage points above that. But they're headed to below, more than he forecast. So if you think that your house is going to be worth more next year, wake up and smell the coffee. Hey, let me give you a mid-course reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling and asking for it. The number to call is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the news, reality behind the news. Oftentimes, we don't get all the facts from Katie and Brian, but we do from some of the newsletters, and so I just wanted to hit some of the top stories that are out there in the marketplace today. Now, here's a letter that really hit the nail on the head. It's written by a soldier in the Army, and it's on page 10. It's called Military Pay. So if you're a soldier and you're getting paid, you know, your salary in the military. And if you're not, you know, if you're just a Joe Sixpack like me, I read this, I didn't know what military pay was. Now, I remember my dad said in World War II he was getting $69 a month in board and room as a soldier. And during those years back in the 1940s, you know, during World War II, $69 was worth a little more than it is today. During the Depression years, CCC camp people were getting paid $25 a month and board and room. They'd keep $5 and send $20 home and support their families on $20 a month. Keep $5 for themselves. And they thought they were cutting a fat hog in the back. If it wasn't fat, at least, you know, it was a live pig. Well, listen to this story. I've gotten to the point that I think that anyone running for Congress or the White House should have been in the military. Cindy Williams was appointed by President Obama as an assistant director for national security in the Congressional Budget Office. She wrote an article on military pay. And this is an airman's response to Cindy Williams' editorial piece in the Washington Times about military pay. And I think it should be printed in every newspaper across America. Now, Ms. Cindy Williams wrote a piece for the Washington Times on behalf of the government, denouncing the pay raises coming service members way this year, citing that she stated a 13% wage increase was more than they deserve. So in case you people are in the military, you're going to get a 13% pay raise this year. And it's way more than you deserve, according to Ms. Cindy Williams. Now, a young airman from Hill Air Force Base responded to her article below. He ought to get a bonus for writing this article. He begins by saying, Ms. Williams, I just had the pleasure of reading your column. Our GIs earn enough, and I'm a bit confused. And frankly, I'm wondering where this vaunted overpayment is going, because as far as I can tell, it disappears every month somewhere between DFAS, the Defense Finance and Accounting Service, and my bank account. When I checked my latest earnings statement, I see that I make $1,117.80 a month before taxes. After my taxes are taken out, I take home $874.20. Now, when I run that through my calculator, I come up with an annual salary of $13,413.60 a year before taxes and $10,490.40 after taxes. Now, I work in the Air Force Network Control Center, where I am part of the team responsible for a 5,000-host computer network. I am involved with infrastructure segments, specifically with Cisco Systems Equipment. Now, a quick check under jobs for network technicians in the Washington, D.C. area reveals that a position in my career field requiring 3 years' experience in my job. Amazingly, this job does not pay $13,413.60 a year. No siree. This job, being offered in the Washington, D.C. area, pays $70,000 to $80,000 per year. Now, I'm sure, Miss Williams, that you can draw the obvious conclusion. Now, given the tenor of your column, I would assume that you never had the pleasure of serving your country in the armed forces. So before you take it upon yourself to once more castigate congressional and DOD leadership for attempting to get the families in the military's lowest pay brackets off of WIC and food stamps, I would suggest that you join a group of deploying soldiers headed for Afghanistan. I leave the choice of service branch up to you. And whichever service you choose, you make the opt for the 6-month rotation. It will guarantee you the longest possible time away from your family and friends, thus giving you the full deployment experience. Then, as your group prepares to board the plane, make sure to note the spouses and children who are saying goodbye to their loved ones, and also take care to note that several families are still unsure of how they'll be able to make ends meet while the primary breadwinner is gone off to war. Obviously, they've been squandering these vast piles of cash that the government has been giving them. Then try to deploy over a major holiday, you know, say Christmas or Thanksgiving, which are perennial favorites. And then you'll actually see over there, sitting in a foxhole, shivering against the cold desert night, and the flight sergeant tells you that there aren't enough people on shift to relieve you for chow. Remember this. And then trade whatever MREs, those are called meal ready to eat, you trade those and you manage to get for the tuna noodle casserole or cheese tortellini, and then add some Tabasco to everything to kill the taste and give it some flavor. Then talk to your loved ones as often as you are permitted. It won't be nearly long enough or often enough, but take what you can get and then be thankful for it. You can have picked up on the fact that I disagree with most of the points that you present in your op-ed piece. But tomorrow from Kabul, I will defend to the death your right to say it. You see, I'm an American fighting man, a guarantor of your First Amendment right and every other right that you cherish on a daily basis. My brother and sister soldiers worldwide ensure that you and people like you can thumb your collective noses at us, all on a salary that is nothing short of pitiful and under conditions that would make most people cringe. We hemorrhage our best and brightest into the private sector because we can't offer the stability and pay of civilian companies. And you, Miss Williams, have the gall to say that we make more than we deserve. That's the end of the article. That's the letter that was written by A1C Michael Bragg, Hill Air Force Base, AFNCC. I guess that means Afghanistan. And then Bob Chapman said, if you agree, please pass this along to as many people as possible and show your support of American fighting men and women. Thank you. Now, that's Bob Chapman. So I took you up on it, Bob, and I put it out over the air, and I'm putting that out there for every listener. in 123 countries around the world that listen to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. I think it was well said, and I think it was well put. Now, I'm not a bleeding heart liberal here, and I'm not trying to get pay raises for the military, but I want to tell you a little story here while I'm at it, about the insanity of not paying these people. See, this kid that's over there in Afghanistan, eating these MREs cold, wherever he is, he's not going to reenlist in the Army. You can rest assured that he's probably had about as much as he can handle. My boy Ted reenlisted one time. In high school, he went through high school, and he went through that military thing in the high school. I forgot the name of it now. ROTC. And he loved it. He had a great time. And when he turned 18, he joined the Army, and he was in for, I guess it was 4 years or 6 years before he reenlisted again. And then he reenlisted. But he quit. He got a belly full of that, and he said, hell, I'm getting out of here. And he did. He didn't spend his 20 or 30 years in the military. And I want to tell you why. Years ago, my brother-in-law, Johnny Tyson, was an Air Force captain. And he was flying big airplanes. I don't remember exactly the size, but you know these C-124s. And I don't know if he flew the C-5A, but he was flying these big military airplanes over to Vietnam, hauling troops and supplies over there. And he was a pretty skilled guy. And we were talking one day up at Travis Air Force Base in his little house. He lived in a little house. And I looked at his little house. He had a wife and three kids. And at the time, I was a machinist working in the trades in Alameda, California, making $3.28 an hour, you know, which was standard pay at the time. And it was good pay, and I was living well. No complaints. But I want to point out that I was making $3.28 an hour, and when I looked at his little house on the Air Force base, and this guy is an Air Force captain. This guy ain't a buck private now. He's a captain in the Air Force. And he isn't living anywhere near as well as I am. And in fact, his pay scale was less than mine, and I was a crummy machinist. And this guy is flying multi-million dollar airplanes. And here's the kicker. He could leave the Air Force anytime he wanted and go to work for United Airlines and make $100,000 a year. And at the time, I think he was making about $10,000 a year, something like that. Maybe not even. And we were chit-chatting a little bit, and he said, now, when I re-enlist, I get an enlistment bonus. And they will pay me. I think at the time it was $1,500 cash. So just hand him a cash bonus if he reenlists for six more years. And I said, "Are you going to do that?" And he said, "No, no." He said, "I want to serve my country. I want to do what I'm doing, but they're not paying me enough." And this is why they cannot keep people in the Air Force. And I said, well, what seems to be the problem? He says, well, these guys can leave here and go to work and make $100,000. They'll make 10 times what we're getting paid here in the Air Force. And you can see that by this letter. This kid is making $10,000 a year. And if he went to work with the same 3 years in Washington, D.C. area, he would get to $80,000. He'd get eight times as much. And Johnny told me, he said, do you know what it costs to train a pilot for the Air Force? I said, no. He said, it's $100,000 a year. $100,000 to train the pilot. I said, no, you're kidding me. You mean if you leave the Air Force in the morning and you go to work for United Airlines, you mean, Johnny, that we taxpayers will have to pay $100,000 to train your replacement? And he said, yep, that's what it costs. And he said, if the Air Force would give us, the pilots in the Air Force, if you would give us $25,000 or $50,000 bonus each time we reenlist. He said, you couldn't drive us away with a club. And you would save half. And he said, you wouldn't have hardly any turnover. Now, that's the kind of short-sighted nonsense that goes on. Now, think about it. Here's a kid. He's working for, $13,000 a year gross, $10,000 net. He can go to work. The day he leaves the Air Force here, he's going to go into private business somewhere doing the same thing that he was trained to do in the Air Force, and he's going to get paid $70,000 or $80,000 for doing that. And then you and I, the taxpayers, we have to pay to replace this kit. So it's going to cost us, and to train him and give him 3 years' experience, it's going to cost us that much money or more. If we would pay this kid, you know, a reasonable amount of money, $20,000-$30,000 a year, half, less than half of what he's going to get on the outside, he'd stay in the Army. He'd stay in there. These people want to serve. They want to stay in the Army. They like the idea. They want the benefits at the end, the retirement. And they would do that if we would pay them. Now, that was my experience with my brother-in-law, Johnny. And I said at the time, why, my God, this is an insane policy. Nobody in his right mind would do such a thing. And that's why I'm not sure that the people who are running the military services, like Secretary Gates or President of the United States Barack Obama or the Congress of the United States, are, in fact, sane, rational people. I know that as a businessman, I would not want an employee to leave that I have to replace and pay $100,000 to train him. I would pay him more money. And in fact, here in the private sector, out here in the real world, we pay people to keep them. We don't want them to leave. But I notice here in the military, they don't think like that. And of course, they don't have to because the taxpayers have unlimited funds. We're all deep pockets. And so they just go ahead and let this kid leave. And then bitch at him because he's making too much money. 13% of $13,000. How much is that raised? $13,000 times 0.13. We're gonna give this kid $1,700 a year more money. So instead of making $13,000 a year, he's gonna be making $15,000 a year. $15,000. Boys and girls, do you know where the poverty line is in the United States today? It's $20,000 a shade under. That's the poverty line. Hell, this kid's working below the poverty line, for crying out loud. He qualifies for food stamps and aid to families with dependent children, which, of course, is paid for with taxpayer money. But don't you think, just using common sense here, that paying this kid $30,000 a year, $35,000, give him half what he's going to get on the outside, it would keep some more of those guys in there. And I'll bet you that it would make money over the long haul because you don't have to trace a replacement. And I can tell you as a businessman, having to replace somebody costs you more money than paying the guy what he's worth. I mean, I've already tested that. So there's that story for you. Just thought I'd throw that one out there. I told you about home values are falling here. Covered that one. Got the military pay out of the way. Okay, let's take a look here at page 11 and 12. Here's a story for you. The world is entering a recession that may last up to 8 years as the U.S. heads toward a lost decade, similar to Japan's slowdown in the 1990s. This is a fellow by the name of, and I can't pronounce it here, formerly Japan's top currency official. You know, he's Saka Jibiri or something like that. I don't know. I'm not afraid of offending him. He can't understand English anyway. So the world is entering a recession. The world, not just the United States, it's the world entering a recession. The world is set for a long-term structural slump reminiscent of the 1870s, when the average annual growth was about 1%. Sakakibara, who is a professor at the God Only Knows University in Tokyo, said today at a conference in Tokyo, Japan, the slowdown may last 3 or 4 years, and depending upon the circumstances, may drag on for 7 to 8 years, he said. Japan is likely to face a double-dip recession from the summer of next year, and the government should increase bond issuance to support stimulus spending, he said. The nation had 904 trillion yen, that's 10.8 trillion, in outstanding government bonds and borrowings as of June, according to the government data collected by Bloomberg. Now, the United States has a national debt of $14 trillion. Japan, about one-third the size of the United States in population, they have 100 million. They've got a $10 trillion debt. Well, about 95% of Japan's debt is held domestically, which credit rating agencies have said supports the country's creditworthiness even as borrowings approach 200% of gross domestic product. Sakakibara became known as Mr. Yen during his 1997-99 tenure at the Ministry of Finance for his efforts to influence the yen rate through verbal and actual intervention in the currency markets. I want to point that out, that the Japanese have already been through this whole process. They tried the same stimulus program in the 1990s that we're doing today. It failed totally then. They've been in a recession. They have been in negative or very low growth rates for the last 20 years. They call it the lost decade, the decade of the 90s. He says you're going to do the same thing there. So in case you thought you saw green shoots and everything's going to be fine, I thought I'd point this one out to you, that we're probably going to get the same result that the Japanese got after having doing exactly the same thing that the Japanese did. We'll probably get the same result as the Japanese, and that was 10 years of depression, recession, or below normal growth. So there's that story. There's a fiscal flood that threatens to swamp local government budgets across the United States and overflows from file cabinets in the office of Patty Holm. He's the chair of the Michigan Tax Tribunal. Now, I don't have time to read the story, but I'm going to tell you the crux of it. And that is, property values are declining. And when property values decline, then the assessed valuation of the property declines, and so cities and municipalities and counties are taking in less money, which puts them into bankruptcy. Now, that's the bad news for all of us. The good news is, as your property devalues, your property tax should go down. But they're not going to lower your property tax voluntarily unless you push them. So if you're in one of those houses where the property value has declined by 50% or something like that, you should go down and file to have your property tax reduced. And then if they fail to reduce it, you should sue your city or your county to reduce that tax rate. And that's what this article is all about. Tens of thousands of people are suing their cities and counties to have their property taxes reduced because the county won't do it voluntarily. How's that for a plan? Well, I'm out of time here again, boys and girls, so let me give you a final reminder that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log, schedule, and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. I got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.